Welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm your host, Howie Jacobson. Excited to let you know that you can now pre-order my new book, You Can Change Other People, The 4 Steps to Help Employees, Colleagues, Even Family Up Their Game. I wrote it with Peter Bregman, who is my coach teacher, my coaching mentor, and it's now available for pre-order. And when you pre-order, you get a whole bunch of fun, valuable bonuses, including 3 recorded demo conversations where we show you exactly how to go through the 4 steps with real people, and a 1-page cheat sheet so you can follow along. The book itself, when you pre-order, will arrive in your mailbox or inbox on September 22nd, 2021. Here's how to do it. Go to plantyourself.com/pre. That's just P-R-E, all lowercase. That will forward you to the page on the Bregman Partners website that has all the information about how to pre-order. Basically, you just order somewhere, either online or at your local independent bookshop, and you send us the receipt via email, and then you get your bonuses. So I'm really hoping that you will help me make this book a big success. I hope it will. You will find it very valuable, and that once you get it and read it, you'll use it and recommend it to others. And so if you've been listening to this podcast for a while and you have gotten value, this is a really easy way for you to give back. It would be a huge help. So again, that's plantyourself.com/pre, P-R-E, all lowercase. All right, let's get to today's show. Hey, do you remember COVID-19? Of course, it's still with us, and it's still changing our lives and hampering us and hamstringing and causing all sorts of problems, including tens of thousands of hospitalizations and hundreds of deaths per day. But it's a really different beast than it was when it first hit the scene in late 2019 and early 2020. And when you think about it, a lot of our policies haven't changed and a lot of our behaviors haven't changed. And because it's been such a polarized issue with liberals, conservatives, left and right, culture wars going on about it, it's been kind of hard for those of us who were entrenched on one side or the other to notice that things have changed and that maybe the points that were being made 2 years ago, which were not correct then, are now more useful, more accurate, more relevant. So to guide us through the current new COVID scene, including vaccines that were wonderful and are now waning, including a certain type of herd immunity that doesn't seem to prevent reinfection but may prevent severe cases, including new drugs that have proven highly effective, and including new variants that seem to be arising with dizzying speed. I wanted a guide to continue to walk us through it. And so, of course, I turned to my longtime friend, Michael Rothberg, a doctor. He is the vice chair of research at the Cleveland Clinic. And he's been on the podcast twice before, originally in March of 2020 and then in 2021. And so now in 2022, we're surveying the state of COVID, the state of our behaviors, the state of policy, and what we should be doing to keep ourselves safe and still lead complete full lives. So let's get right into it without further ado. Michael Rothberg, welcome back to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Hey, Howie. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So we've talked about COVID 2 or 3 times now, and it seems weird that I understand less about it now than I did a year ago. But apparently, science has advanced. But when I look at the political messages, the messages from medical authorities, when I see what people are doing out in the wild, I'm really confused. So maybe we just begin by what are you seeing out there?
What happened is that COVID has changed. So it's not that, you sort of look at it and you say, oh, well, I thought I figured this out and we should know more and more about it. It's not the same thing. It's not that we learned a lot about what happened in the past, but what happened in the past doesn't necessarily work for what we have in the present. And it used to be that you would just sort of needed to know how much COVID was there in my area to kind of determine your behavior. But now it's not just how much COVID, but which kind of COVID, because we're using the same name for it. We're calling it COVID-19, but it's a different disease now than it was when it started. And so that's why you're getting these changed messages, coming from the official channels. But you've also got people who have dug into some kind of political messages around COVID, which, you know, really were never appropriate in the first place. This wasn't a political disease. This is a public health issue. And so I think that there are some major lessons that we've learned that have been true throughout the pandemic and are still true. And then there are other things that are changing as time goes on, which makes, you know, people's approaches are going to have to vary. And it depends on who you are and where you live and when it is. So I'll go into more detail about those specifics.
Okay. One of the things that I've always, you know, loved about your mind and talking to you is, and I think this is like on your Twitter profile, that like you will change your opinion based on new data. And it's, yeah, I don't like doing that. I find that very tiresome. So when I think about, like, you know, I was on the science side from the very beginning. Like, of course we should close the schools. Of course everybody should mask up. Of course we should social distance. Of course we should have these lockdowns. And like, oh, you know, it's been hard. You know, like I want to sort of continue thinking those things that I thought, because it's easier than changing. Like, what from that sort of liberal, public health, science-minded perspective do you think is no longer valid or has shifted with, you know, with changing times?
Yeah. So let's go back to like the beginning of the pandemic, right? And so at the very beginning, we had this disease which was extremely dangerous with a very high mortality rate, particularly for older people and for people who had various comorbid illnesses. So it was a really dangerous disease, but it also had lots of people who were asymptomatic. And so anyone sort of could be carrying it. And there were lots of people who had relatively mild cases. And so you had to kind of like look at the whole picture to get an idea of, you know, how bad is this and how important is it from a public health perspective for us to try to contain it. And realize at that point, we had basically no treatment for it. The only thing we could do was put people on ventilators when they couldn't breathe anymore. And we didn't have enough ventilators in the country. And the ventilators weren't very effective. That is to say, most of the people that went on the ventilators ended up dying. And so really the only way to try to prevent it was to stop the spread. And so that was why we had, you know, I mean, people talk about lockdowns. I don't remember ever having a lockdown. I remember there were a lot of things that were closed, but certainly in Ohio, we never had a period where we couldn't travel, where I couldn't go outside, where I couldn't go to the park, where I was never locked in my house the way that people in China were. But we had, you know, a real closing of a lot of businesses. And the idea was that we were going to make economic sacrifices in order to preserve public health and save lives. And that was completely appropriate. There was no reason for people to be going and eating in restaurants and, going and gathering in large numbers where they were going to have super spreader events. And one of the other dangers back then was also the hospitals being overwhelmed, as we saw like in New York, and where they're just, you know, the hospitals didn't have enough space to take care of all the people with COVID. And so that was the appropriate approach back then. And then since then, we've had a number of developments that have really changed the need for that. And, you know, I hear a lot of conservatives talking about lockdowns. I haven't seen anything, you know, certainly no lockdowns and nothing that even approached what we had back in the beginning. That is to say, I haven't seen any businesses closed in Ohio since that very first wave of the pandemic. And there's really no reason to close any businesses. And there's also, you know, no reason that people can't gather even in reasonably large numbers. So the things that have changed since the beginning of the pandemic. So first of all, we have vaccine. And so the vaccines have made a huge difference in the severity of the disease, but not recently in the transmission of the disease. So that's one of the things that changed. When the vaccine first came out, it was extremely effective both at preventing the disease and preventing any complications from the disease. So when the vaccine came out and I got my two doses and I had a 95% protection against the disease, I could take off my mask and I could walk around like I was Superman. I could walk around with impunity and I didn't have to worry at all. And what's happened is we discovered two things. One is that the vaccine kind of wears off over time. The protection of the vaccine declines, you know, over a relatively short time, so that by, you know, 6 months after you were vaccinated, you needed to get a booster. But that was okay because we had boosters. So I got a booster and I got a second booster. And I imagine this fall, I'm going to need a third booster. And the other thing that happened is the virus evolved. So we have these variants. I'm sure, we talked about, you've heard in the news, we had Delta and then Omicron, and now we've got sub-variants of Omicron. And each time the virus mutates, it evolves into basically what's almost a new virus. And so the strain that we have now is actually almost impervious to the vaccine in terms of spreading the disease. So just because you're vaccinated and boosted and up to date, you still have very little protection against the current virus in terms of being infected. So if you don't want to be infected, you need to stay away from large groups of people and you need to wear a mask. And the other thing that's happened with the virus is it's become much more infectious. So the first initial COVID was not that easy to catch, the original SARS-CoV-2. But the Omicron variants are really easy to catch, you know, and basically, like, if you're in a room with a bunch of people and somebody's got it, you're going to have it. And so now, you know, wearing a cloth mask is useless. There's no point in wearing a cloth mask. Even a surgical mask is not going to help you very much. You need an N95 or an N99 or an N100. You know, you can get better and better masks. And I'll talk about the masks in particular as one thing. And then we've also got treatment now. So that's also different, right? In the beginning, we had nothing. And then we had steroids that we could give people that helped to reduce the really, really severe people from, going onto a ventilator or from dying. But they didn't keep you from getting COVID. And then we came out with, you know, monoclonal antibodies. And now what we have is the antiviral drugs, which are extremely effective in preventing hospitalization and death. And so, you know, the president's got COVID. He took the Paxlovid and now he's, you know, he basically had a very, very mild course. Now, when you finish your 5 days, sometimes it comes back a little bit, but those people don't end up in the hospital. So, the difference between sort of like when Trump got COVID and when Biden got COVID is sort of night and day. So we can go through a lot of examples of that. So what's changed? So the virus has changed. It is much more infectious than it was. The vaccine doesn't offer the same protection against catching the virus, but does offer the protection against being hospitalized or dying from the virus. And the other thing is that the Omicron variant is much less severe than the Delta, you know, and the original strain. So we are seeing a lot of people hospitalized, and it's not as clear whether they're hospitalized because of the COVID or with the COVID. You know, I mean, a lot of the sort of conservative talking points that you heard early on in the pandemic actually are probably true about the current version of the virus. They were not true back then when they would say, how do you know that the person died from COVID? They didn't just die with COVID. And that was just absolutely not the case back then. But now we've got, you know, lots of people in the hospital with COVID, very, very few in the ICU. So what we haven't been seeing is that same level of severity. One part of that is, you know, there are more people who are vaccinated. One part of it is we got more treatments. But this is also a much less severe version of the disease than what we saw before.
Gotcha. So like when I think about my own risk, and I think I hear about people getting COVID mm-hmm. now, it's like they feel crappy for a week or a few days. Like, well, you know, I've done that. I could handle that. But then there's sort of the long shot of long COVID. And is long COVID mm-hmm. still a thing with the Omicron subvariants or?
Yeah. Who knows? Right. So that's part of like, you know, as the new variants come out, we don't know all of the stuff about what the new variants represent, right? So the first thing we see with the new variants is, well, how many people are being hospitalized with them? And a few weeks after that, we find out how many people were hospitalized, end up in the ICU, and how many of them die. And then months after that, you might get an idea of how many of them get long COVID. You know, so I think a lot of what we're looking at about long COVID now is, you know, at the latest, the Delta variant, you know, people presenting with long COVID from, you know, and so we don't really know. But I tend to think that, you know, that these later variants, the Omicron variants, are probably less likely to cause long COVID. But that is just a guess. You know, we don't have the data to back that up yet. We'll have to wait and find out. So, you know, in terms of like, you know, how should you think about this for yourself? So I think that, you know, the first question is, which risk category do you consider yourself to be in? So if you're healthy and you're young, so when I say young, I'm going to say under the age of 50. You really have very little to fear from getting COVID. You know, it's going to be unpleasant, but, you know, the chances of your ending up in the hospital or dying from COVID is very, very, very small. And that was true all the way along, but it's even more, you know, more true now. And if you're young and you've been vaccinated, which is even better, and there's really no reason for young people not to be vaccinated, then that's, you know, that's great. You can really relax. You know, three of my four children have had COVID. You know, they live their lives a lot more fully than I do and my wife does. You know, we're a little bit more limited in what we do. We're over 50 and, you know, also going to large gatherings indoors is not so exciting for us. So it's not a big deal for us to miss out on that. But you know, we do go to small events. You know, if we're indoors, we wear a mask. If we're outdoors, then we don't. And I think there's, you know, a reasonable chance I will get COVID at some point, but I'm not trying to get it. And I, you know, take reasonable precautions to try to avoid it.
Yeah. Well, I remember when we first talked, you know, over two and a half years ago, just when it was heating up, you were like, you know, we don't know, like if someone gets COVID, like maybe all those people could then like take care of the sick people and they would be immune. Like, like we had this fantasy of like,
well, the immunity
like
thing. Other.
Yeah, go ahead.
The immunity thing is interesting, right? So I've written a bunch of papers about, you know, the effects of prior infection on future infection. And so if you've been infected, it does offer you some degree of immunity. It's just that the virus keeps changing. So people that got the original strain were protected actually even against Delta. But they had very little protection against Omicron. And people with Delta had, you know, who got Delta had actually pretty good protection against Omicron. Now we're looking to see whether people that, you know, got Omicron are protected against the Omicron variants. So, you know, it's a moving target because the virus keeps changing. But basically, if you were infected before Delta, you should not consider that that gives you any protection against the current variants.
Gotcha. So is there,
I would go and get vaccinated even if I had been infected.
Gotcha. Do the names mean anything? Like are the Omicron subvariants like all connected in some particular way, or is it more like Apple names operating systems? Like one day they decide, okay, this one's 12 and the last one was 11.
So the names are just, you know, Greek letters in order. It does have to do with how different it is from the previous virus. But they're not necessarily more closely related to the previous letter. So the Omicron variant, for example, is more closely related to the original strain than it is to the Delta strain. There is some, you know, the subvariants are still related to the same variant, you know, more closely than they would be to a previous letter. But,
okay,
you know, that's we don't know about how much previous infection will protect you against these new ones. And we keep hearing about, you know, there are lots and lots of people who have been infected and reinfected more than once. But, you know, just because of some people are reinfected doesn't mean that you don't have any protection. And so I think that's part of, you know, what we're trying to understand is how much does infection with any particular strain help to protect you going forward? And, you know, one of the questions that's come up is that, you know, is Omicron so much less serious because there's so much, you know, immunity in the population, either from previous infection or from vaccination or both, so that there are very few people who haven't been exposed in one way or another, you know, to these viral proteins that allows them to have some basic immunity, or is it something actually intrinsic to the virus itself? I don't know that it really matters that much, you know, as long as you took the opportunity to be vaccinated, if you could be, or if you got infected before you got vaccinated, you know, you're going to have some protection from that.
Yeah. So one of the things that I've been a little bit confused about is, you know, vaccination, when it was first announced, was like a public health measure. You're doing it for yourself, but you're really doing it for the community. And like it seems like, at least some of the things I've been reading, that the global vaccination rates, which have been pretty low in many parts of the world, present a danger to us, because that's like the more transmission, the more opportunity for variation. And like it seems like we could be in this cycle forever. Like every year there's going to be new COVIDs because they keep mutating in people. What's the truth behind that?
Yeah. I mean, every year we have new influenzas, and, you know, that's been going on for hundreds of years, and we never freaked out about that before, you know, and they estimate somewhere between, you know, 100,000 to 250,000 people die a year in the United States from influenza. But we don't necessarily diagnose them with influenza. We just know that during influenza season, there's going to be a lot of excess deaths. And they don't necessarily die from, you know, viral pneumonia. They might die from complications of other things. They get a bacterial pneumonia, or they have a heart attack, or they have a stroke that's brought on by the influenza. And, you know, we try to vaccinate people against influenza. Our vaccines aren't great. It's hard to get people to agree to be vaccinated, even high risk people. It's hard to get them to agree to do it. That was long before COVID. We couldn't get people to be vaccinated against the flu. So I think it's going to be more like that. But, you know, every once in a while, there's a really horrible flu that comes out that, you know, and in 1918, you had one that, you know, killed, you know, hundreds of millions of people around the globe. So I think we could have, you know, every decade or or every 20 years, maybe a really serious strain of COVID that's going to kill a lot of people in the same way that we had influenza. So, I think it is going to keep mutating and whatnot. I guess one point that I should try to make is that I think there's been a real shift, both in our public health approach, but also having to do with the tools that we have at our disposal. And that was what I was trying to get at the beginning, was that in the beginning, the goal was to try to stop the spread of COVID. We are no longer trying to do that. In the beginning, the idea was I should try to protect the community. I should get vaccinated to protect other people. I should wear a mask to protect other people. We have left that strategy behind. Now, the Chinese are still pursuing that strategy, right? They are still trying for zero COVID, and it is stymieing them, and it is actually really bogging down their economy. And it's reverberating here, right? A lot of our inflation has to do with supply chain issues, and some of that is because factories are closed in China because they're trying to get to zero COVID. And, you know, it just looks like that's not possible. We have shifted our strategy, and we're sort of at now what you do is to protect yourself. And so everything that we do is to protect ourselves. And it's totally reasonable as a strategy, because our ability to prevent the spread to everybody else is not great. You know, we could have everybody wear masks all the time, but people hate wearing masks, and it really, it detracts from quality of life, and it detracts from, people interacting with each other. And you see the happiness, I went to a medical conference, just the happiness of people being able to get together again, even if they're wearing masks. And people being able to travel and see their loved ones. And so I'm really glad that those original things are no longer necessary. But as an individual, now you have to think about what are the risks to you? And so, again, if you're young and healthy, the risks are pretty small. And so you may decide to take fewer precautions. If you're in your 70s or 80s and you have some health concerns, you should be really careful. So what does that mean? It means when you're indoors, try not to be with large numbers of people. That doesn't mean you can't see your immediate family or have a few friends that you get together with. And when you're indoors, you may want to wear a mask. For sure, if you need to go into a large group of people indoors, you should be wearing a mask. And the kind of mask you should wear at the very least is a well-fitting N95 mask. They also make N99s and N100s. Those filter out even more particles, and those are probably the best protection, but they are more expensive. So, that's a kind of trade-off. But I would say an N95 that's kind of like the minimum level of protection that you want if you're going into a group of people, because the other masks, just they're not going to do it with the current variants that we have.
So I've been seeing something in the news about elastomeric masks. That I guess are, you buy them once for like $30 to $60, and then you change the filter like once a month or a couple times a year. But most of them look like, World War I gas masks. I think some are a little more stylish. Trash crisis.
It really just depends on, how much time do you need to spend with other people, and how uncomfortable are the masks that you have? I use N95s. I buy them at Home Depot, and, they're $1 or $2 a piece, and, I'll wear it probably 8 hours. I have to go into work and work in my, seeing patients half a day a week. So that's 4 hours that I got the mask on. It's pretty miserable. I wear the mask when I go to synagogue, because it's a room full of people and they're singing, and you know, only about half of them are wearing masks. So again, I want to protect myself. But I don't avoid those, you know, those interactions. And I would go to the theater, or I would go to, you know, the symphony, but I would wear a mask for that too. Rather do stuff outside. I love doing stuff outside, and you can see it, you know, every summer we've got the waves in the south where people are going indoors because it's too hot out. And then in the winter, we get the waves in the north when it's too cold out. So uh-huh. The outside, even with the new variants, I think is still pretty safe.
Gotcha. So I just have a sort of a grab bag of questions that I've been jotting down. One of them Great. Is about testing and sort of public health reporting. So, you know, every day I read the New York Times, and it has the list of new cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. And I don't know that anyone's reporting new cases. Like, what is there any value in those numbers anymore?
There's values in the numbers. First of all, the hospitalizations for sure, right? Because everyone who gets admitted to the hospital gets tested. So we have some idea of, you know, what the rates of hospitalization are for the whole population. We don't know the rates per infection, but you can be pretty sure that, you know, whatever rates are reported, it's probably something like 10 times that many, because now everyone's getting diagnosed at home and they don't report it to anybody. But I think we still do have a good idea of how many hospitalizations and how many deaths there are. And you'll see, I mean, if you look at the deaths, they've really, you know, they really dropped off, and you haven't seen a rise with the latest wave. So I think that, you know, this is a much less dangerous variant than what we had before.
Gotcha. What do you think about home testing these days? You know, I would get my 8 kits, you know, from the Postal Service, and I know people who are like, I'm sure I have COVID, but I keep testing negative. Like, is there a responsible way to test for yourself and others?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, if you think about, you know, what if you knew you had the flu? What if you knew you had some other, you know, I mean, you know, when you have a respiratory infection, and the question is, how much do you care about other people and trying to keeping them from getting it? And so keeping them from getting COVID is kind of like keeping them from getting the flu. Like, you know, if you know you're positive, or even if you didn't know you had COVID, but you know, you've got some other miserable respiratory infection, you know, try to wear a mask. Don't give it to other people. You know, I mean, it's if you went around like in Asia, you know, 10, 20 years ago, you see lots of people wearing masks in public. It's very normal there. In the United States, you know, you look like some kind of a pariah walking around with a mask before COVID, and people would wonder, you know, but there it's sort of like, you know, it's polite. If you have a cold, you don't want to give it to other people. You wear a mask. And so, you know, I think that people could do that here too. That is to say, you know, if you're infected and you test negative, just wear a mask around other people so that you know, are less likely to give it to them. And, you know, don't invite them to come over your house until you're feeling better.
Yeah. I have to say that it's like, you know, okay, so I don't have any symptoms, but I know that other people aren't going to think that way. Like, when I go to Costco or the supermarket, I kind of like to wear a mask now.
Yeah.
Just for like whatever germs people have gotten, they're going to be coughing and sneezing up in the air.
Yeah. And you know, I do that too. I don't know if COVID went away, if I would still do it. But, you know, like I said, I don't like wearing a mask, but I really, you know, it's been like 2.5 years since I had my last upper respiratory infection. And it's kind of nice. Like, you know, I mean, I used to get sidelined for at least a few days every year. You know, it never kept me from going to work, but I felt crappy. And now I never have that. So, you know, that seems like an advantage to me, but that's a personal choice. This is like a lot of those things is like that they were saying at the beginning of the pandemic. A lot of those things have come true now. You know, it is a personal choice. You're deciding for yourself how much protection you want to have. You don't have to worry. You know, one of the things that has like really bothered me in sort of liberal spaces is this thing where now they say, you know, like if I want to go to my scientific meeting, I have to show proof of vaccination. What the hell? The vaccine doesn't prevent the transmission of Omicron. So why do I have to be vaccinated? I'm vaccinated because I want to protect myself so I don't get hospitalized. But I don't think that my meeting should decide whether or not I am going to get hospitalized, right? I mean, that I don't think it's their job to protect me against myself. But, you know, having them require everyone to wear masks seems very reasonable. So they're going to try to keep people from spreading it within the thing. It's just that vaccination doesn't prevent spread anymore. Maybe the new one that comes out in the fall will help because there's going to be an Omicron vaccine that comes out. That will presumably help to prevent the spread of Omicron. But by the time it comes out, we may be into the next letter.
You know? Right. So, yeah, there's another question, about the new vaccines. And of course, they're always going to be playing catch up. I read recently about an AI computer that is now doing like protein folding, which is, you know, an exceedingly difficult problem for humans to solve. But apparently, like this AI, DeepMind or something, has like done more proteins in the last 3 months than humans had done through history until now. And so, since the virus is essentially protein, is it going to be, you know, can you just sort of like, do you see a time in the near future where vaccines are just going to be like, you know, produced like publish on demand?
Well, I mean, it's not that far from that right now. It's just that, you know, the process of getting it up and running takes a while, you know, just to get it, you know, into production, to make enough of it, and then to ship it to all the places to vaccinate 100 million people or 500 million people. Like that's a process, right? I mean, you can get the first ones out maybe in a month or two. But, you know, there's testing and there's regulatory approvals and there's all kinds of stuff. Like, it's not going to happen, you know, that you need one and they're going to make it at your local CVS and you can go pick it up. I mean, these are still made in, you know, highly technical factories that there's only a few in the whole world. And so I don't see that happening. But I was surprised that it took this long for them to come up with a booster that was specific to a variant instead of using a booster from a from a virus that's 2 years old.
Uh-huh. It seems weird that vaccines are still mostly delivered subcutaneously. Like it seems like a pretty awkward way to do it. Are there technologies around vaccination that could be, you know, oral or nasal or dermal?
Yeah, there are. I mean, you know, and they've been used with, you know, varying success. We got the oral polio vaccine was around for a long, long time. And the problem with the oral polio vaccine is that it's a weakened virus, but it can revert in a very small number of cases to a sort of a wild type virus. And now we've got polio cases in New York that are vaccine derived. Hmm. So, so there are risks to that. There's a nasal flu vaccine, which was very popular for a while. And then it ended up not being effective for a number of years. And so I think that this is just the technology that we're most familiar with and that's had the most testing and seems to be, you know, to work consistently. I don't think that most people are choosing not to be vaccinated because they're afraid of needles. I think that, you know, it's other things going on. And what we saw, you know, when they came out with the nasal vaccine for flu, they thought, oh, this is going to get kids vaccinated, you know, because kids are afraid of needles. Turns out kids don't like having stuff squirted up their nose either.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, if only we could give vaccines via video games.
But the other thing that, you know, that AI and is, you know, there's drug development. And when you look at how quickly they came up with the antiviral pills, you know, compared to how long it took to develop antivirals for other diseases, it was really, really rapid. You know, we had remdesivir within like a year, and Paxlovid now, you know, like 2 years after the thing, and it's extremely effective. You know, I mean, the fact that you can reduce death by 90% with a pill is really pretty extraordinary.
Hmm. So talking about other ways of reducing your risk, you know, in my community, sort of, you know, plant-based lifestyle medicine, when this all started happening, we were all screaming like, okay, this is an example of how chronic diseases all of a sudden became acute. Is there evidence around, you know, healthy lifestyle things that can protect you even if you get it, even if you get COVID or some variant?
I'm not sure that after you've gotten it, that there's much you can do at that point. But I think certainly if you're living a healthy lifestyle, you know, if you're physically fit and you're not obese and you don't have diabetes, and, you know, that all of those things help to protect you, you know, from getting COVID in the first place. Or if you get it, having a, you know, a sort of a milder case. You know, part of what happens is as we age, you know, chronic diseases are basically just a process of aging. And so if you're able to maintain your, you know, sort of like your real age as younger than your biological age, then you're going to do better. Hmm. But again, you know, if you look at the vast majority of people who died of COVID were over the age of 75. So if you're 25 or 30, it's hard to, you know, really do that much to change your risk because your risk just isn't very high. But I think that and you shouldn't think that like, oh, if I do all this stuff, then I don't need to wear a mask or, you know, I'm going to be like, you know, these diseases have evolved to kill people and infect people at least. And they're very good at it. So, I don't
take off my seatbelt just because I stop at red lights. Like,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lots and lots of reasons to eat healthy, you know, to eat healthy food and in moderate amounts and to exercise. Like, you don't need COVID to get you to do that. There are so many other things so many other benefits that you get from it. So I would say COVID might be a small, tiny side effect of it, but I wouldn't make that my main driver.
Okay.
The one thing that I don't think has been resolved yet, you know, is that there are some randomized trials of vitamin D to prevent upper respiratory infections in general, not specifically COVID. That does seem to be maybe the one thing that vitamin D actually has been shown to do in randomized trials, but it's only for people who are vitamin D deficient.
Okay.
So, you know, during COVID, I've been taking vitamin D in the winter, and I'm not at all convinced that it's doing anything, but it's easy enough to do.
Yeah. I saw some interesting research that I didn't dive into enough to be able to evaluate. Someone said that vitamin D was actually sort of a marker of light exposure, and that may be more important, sort of, you know, light on the skin might.
Yeah.
You know, might.
I mean, what we know is that vitamin D levels are associated with all kinds of things, like everything, you know, cancer and heart disease and diabetes and all-cause mortality, you name it, like pretty much anything bad. If your vitamin D levels are low, you're more likely to have that thing. Mm-hmm. What's unfortunate is that, you know, there have been lots and lots of randomized trials looking at giving people vitamin D. The most recent one came out last week that showed that vitamin D doesn't prevent fractures in people who have osteoporosis. You know, and that's sort of like, if anything that you needed vitamin D for, it was that. So I think that, you know, we've really seen study after study after study show that by giving vitamin D, you don't change anything except for this one thing, which is upper respiratory infections. There have been a bunch of studies, and it does look like if you're vitamin D deficient and you take vitamin D, you will reduce your risk of upper respiratory infections. Whether that applies to COVID, we don't know. But vitamin D is cheap, and it, you know, it doesn't seem to be harmful. I wouldn't take tons of it, you know, 1,000 units a day or something. And that's probably, you know, and it may not work for that either, you know. But in terms of like why vitamin D levels are associated with all these other things, we don't know. So sunshine, sure, that's a possibility, you know, but, you know, I don't know what else sunshine would do for you that would, you know, make you less likely to get cancer, for example.
Yeah. Well, I saw something recently about we can actually photosynthesize a little bit if we, you know, if you have a lot of leafy greens and then the chlorophyll is in your blood that actually the, you know, like inside your skull is not that dark, apparently, like, you know, so I don't know. Well, what I will say is I take a daily vitamin D and K2, and it's delicious. It's like a really wonderful little gummy.
So, I mean, you know, the whole idea of vitamins, you know, they were really, really exciting when people discovered them because the deficiencies of vitamins, you know, cause really recognizable syndromes, which are, you know, sometimes devastating. You know, you look at what scurvy used to do, you know, to sailors and Antarctic explorers. And I mean, this was the thing that people were terrified of and had no idea what caused it. And, you know, we really have no reason to have it anymore. And so, you know, the vitamins are absolutely essential to life. But, you know, if you eat a healthy diet, you're going to get plenty of vitamins. There's no shortage. So, you know, there's billion-dollar industries of, you know, selling people stuff that they don't need. I don't know if I can say that on your show, but there's no scientific evidence, really, any of the vitamins. But, you know, there's people like to take them. So,
yeah. Well, there goes Solaray as a sponsor, damn it. No. So the other thing I was curious about is when, you know, when we first started talking, this was in March of 2020, you were kind of shocked at the unpreparedness and the incompetence of sort of the public health infrastructure around like how few tests the CDC had and how slowly they ramped up. So now we've got monkeypox, which as you know, like, have we learned anything from COVID? Are we better equipped? What's going on? Why, like, is it just sort of political sniping and this new thing that people are really working on hard? Or do we still have this level of apathy and incompetence?
No, I don't think, I mean, I think the thing is with COVID, you know, monkeypox is not COVID. COVID, this was a highly transmissible thing, and you could see it coming for a couple of months. You know, you saw what it did in China, you saw what it did in Italy, and if you thought that it wasn't going to do that here, you know, you had to be sticking your head in the ground to think that somehow it wasn't going to come to America. This is something that's transmitted through the air to everybody. Well, I guess back then we didn't know it was coming through the air, but you know, it was just like, it was so obvious that it was being transmitted, you know, that you had to have some kind of denial or some kind of, I don't know, racism is the right word for it, but to think that like, you know, we are Americans somehow different from these other people. We aren't going to need these tests. We aren't going to need, you know, but we've come a long way from that. You know, we do have tests for monkeypox and we do have vaccine for monkeypox. And, you know, it's just that, you know, we haven't had to give it out before. And so, you know, now we realize it hasn't been here for that long. I think they'll ramp it up. I think they'll get it under control. You know, I think that in the beginning it was, you know, sort of thought that this is only through sort of so close sexual contact. And that always makes a lot of people say, well, it doesn't apply to me. I don't need to worry about it. And And then, you know, sort of like, well, it's kind of like a punishment that people are getting for their morality. And, you know, so maybe we shouldn't do anything about it anyway. And so, but, you know, I think that, you know, most of the scientific community is bought into it. I think the government's concerned about it. And I think that, you know, as the cases have ramped up, their attention has ramped up. And I think they'll get it under control.
Okay. Do we know how it spreads beyond sexual contact between males?
No, but I mean, we know that it's spread through contact. So if you touch the, you know, if you touch somebody who's got it, if you touch the vesicles, that, you know, that's sort of the main way of spread. We don't know if there's some airborne spread as well, but it's clearly not. You know, this isn't something that's being spread through the air at Costco. And the fact that it was so concentrated in homosexuals in the beginning, you know, implies that there is a certain degree of close contact that's required. Otherwise, you wouldn't have seen that pattern. So, no, I don't think that we know completely how it spread, but I also don't think that, you know, I think it's mostly going to be close contact and, you know, you should feel comfortable going into Costco and buying your stuff and don't worry about it too much.
So when you look at
people our age, we got smallpox vaccines. So, you know, we should be pretty protected.
Oh, cool. So a little decoration on my arm. Coming handy.
It did something. Yeah.
All right. So when you look at like the next 10 years in terms of public health, in terms of like, you know, how COVID was politicized, how it played into a polarization. Like, do you think we're better prepared now? Do you think like, what are like knowing that things happen, that diseases happen, there's, you know, 100-year cycles of plague and things like that. What are you hopeful about and what are you worried about?
Ooh, well, I mean, I'm very hopeful about the science. I mean, our response to this was, you know, the speed with which they developed the vaccines and the effectiveness of the vaccines. And, you know, when you think about, like, you know, it was such a triumph with HIV that, you know, within, I don't know, a year or two of the time that they really understood that HIV was this thing, they had actually figured out what the virus was that caused it, and they had sequenced the virus and whatever. And then within, you know, sort of 20 to 30 years, we had converted it from a death sentence into just a sort of a chronic disease with a pill that you take once a day, and it's pretty well controlled with that, right? And then, you know, COVID, you know, within a couple of weeks of the first case, we got the thing sequenced. We know what's causing it. And, you know, within a year, we've got a vaccine for it that's highly effective. And then we've got medications for it. I mean, like our scientific abilities are just, you know, moving at a tremendous clip. And so I'm very hopeful about that in terms of, you know, our ability to fight disease in the future. That the medicine is just really, really good. And what we discovered was that the politics are really, really bad. And I don't think that has anything to do with the disease itself. I think it's the period that we're living through, and it's not just here, it's every country around the globe. And, you know, that makes me, you know, worried. I think we've talked about this before. It's, you know, it's looks a lot like the 1930s, and that didn't turn out well. So, you know, I think that I think this is a bad time in, you know, in a lot of ways. You know, we've got all kinds of international problems, and the same kind of polarization that's taking place within the country is taking place outside of the country. And this just isn't it's not a very cooperative time for humans. Hopefully that'll pass without some kind of big, horrible conflict. But, you know, I'm very optimistic about the science and the ability of humans to get a handle on the causes of disease and to make progress.
Hmm. Yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, it's, you know, it's part of this bigger context. I mean, I'm, you know, full disclosure, I'm looking at, like, are there other countries to go to? And you know, the more I look, say, like, well, okay, that country looks like it might be politically stable, but we look like we were politically stable in 2015. And how fast that changed.
Yeah.
And what about, you know, the climate? Like, I'm feeling like, you know, we didn't move to North Carolina as sort of like this survivalist bunker mentality, but like, goodness, we haven't had heat domes. We haven't had flash floods. We haven't had, you know, a terrible destructive hurricane in 25 years. We haven't, you know, like, it seems like, oh, I kind of, you know, we're kind of lucked out here, but like, who knows what, you know, where is going to be habitable or pleasant or sustainable for humans. Ohio.
Yeah. All the people who left, come back. We have lovely weather. disasters. No, you know, everything seems to like shift around us in both directions. The heat waves, the thunderstorms, the everything.
So, and all you had to do was have teams, sports teams that never won, and that was the deal.
Yes,
that struck.
Yes, that's our compensation.
All right. Anything else you wanted to talk about around COVID or that we haven't covered?
No, I think we pretty much hit all the highlights of it. You know.
Okay. Oh, you know what? I did have one more question.
That main thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Every couple of weeks, I see a new newspaper article about scientists think they figured out what causes long COVID or what characteristics predispose people to long COVID, or like, what do you know about what we know about?
I don't think we know very much about long COVID, you know, and I think it may, you know, if we ever do solve it, it may give us a window into understanding some of these other conditions. You know, there are a lot of things out there. You probably remember from like the 1990s, people with chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, you know, these are the things that are like the bane of, you know, primary care doctors' existence, you know, people, because they have these diseases that, you know, you go and you look and you can't find any lab values that are abnormal, but it really affects people's lives, you know, and they feel terrible and the doctors feel terrible. And a lot of them are depressed. And I think long COVID kind of falls into that same, you know, category. And it's people that think they have chronic Lyme disease. And, you know, these are just all like, you know, kinds of symptoms that, you know, they're subjective symptoms, you know, lots of headaches and trouble concentrating and whatever, but you can't, you know, sort of do an EEG and see where their thinking has gone wrong or where the headache is coming from, or an MRI doesn't show anything. And, you know, so I think that we're really, if we make any progress on this, maybe it'll give us a window into understanding all of these conditions.
Mm. Well, you know, in times past, people who couldn't be served by, you know, the lab tests and diagnostics of traditional medicine would go to alternatives, would go to, you know, different kinds of healers. Now it seems everybody's going to functional medicine, which, like, these people typically have MDs. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's, you know, I don't know in terms of scientific evidence if there's anything to it. It certainly talks a good game, like, oh, this makes sense. Like, you know, they can't see it on these lab tests.
Yeah.
Like, is there anything to it as far as the science?
We've done a few studies of functional medicine, and the one consistent finding is that the people that participate in the functional medicine lose more weight than control patients.
Oh.
So it does seem to be good for weight loss. I'm not sure if it does anything else. Oh, uh-huh. And people feel better. And so that's not, you know, that's not a thing to minimize. They do feel better. So, you know, in terms of their like patient reported outcomes, the people in functional medicine do feel better. You know, whether you know, we haven't seen that it's made any difference in anything, any, you know, physiological measures other than weight. So I think that, you know, a lot of functional medicine is diet changes. Mm-hmm. And I think that eating a healthier diet, it makes people lose weight.
Uh-huh.
I mean, all of these things, like if they get back to, you know, eat a healthy diet and exercise, like that gets you a long way. That seems to be a foundation of a lot of these different things. And then after that, it's all, you should pay me money because I have this secret trick that nobody else knows about. Uh-huh. But at the heart of both of those things, you know, is the diet and the exercise. And I'm not sure that there's one particular diet that's, you know, the one that everybody needs to follow. But, you know, we do know the things that people shouldn't eat. And that's what most Americans are eating. So,
You know, but. So it's kind of a little bit like stone soup or something like, you know, take this pill after eating a salad and going for a 30-minute walk.
Yeah. Cool. But take this specific combination of these vitamins that are manufactured by this particular manufacturer, because, you know, they're the only ones who make the real stuff. All the other ones, you can't trust them. And you need to have this combination for your particular problem. And, you know, I don't know that any of that stuff makes a difference.
Gotcha. Cool. Well, so eating right and exercising, you heard it here first. That's why this podcast is on the cutting edge. So, cool. Well, Michael, it's always a pleasure.
Always great to talk with you, Alan.
Yeah, this is fun. We gotta make this gotta put it in my calendar regularly. Sort of a reality check. So
absolutely. Happy to join you again.
Cool. Again, love the background, love the choice of colors. Is that paint or fabric all over on your walls?
That is paint.
Oh.
The house came like this. We said, oh, we gotta change that. But that was 10 years ago, so.
Well, I'm sure it's a wavelength that supports your higher brain functioning and cellular activity.
Absolutely.
So. All right, man. So I'm gonna stop the recording. Yeah, I see. You're one of the only people who is uploading slower than me. I don't know if I can move to Ohio, but we have to keep the. This window open after we close the recording before it completely uploads. So you'll.
Sounds good.
So I'll have to follow you later. All right, man. Catch you later. All right. And you can check out the show notes for today's episode and watch the conversation on video at plantyourself.com/528. Love your comments, thoughts, questions for Michael. We can always have him back again. You know, he and I, again, as I said, are old childhood friends. We met in the fall of 1977. And so we always like a good excuse to get together and connect and talk about stuff. So garden news, I have a new project, which is I've sort of neglected in the front. We have the septic field and then a kind of a pine stand. And pine trees drop pine cones, which contain pine seeds. Pine nuts, as it were, which grow into new pine trees. So having neglected that for about 4 or 5 years, the pine trees, like the woods in Macbeth or Lord of the Rings, are slowly marching towards our house. And you do not want a pine tree towering over your house because they fall down in storms and wind and heavy rains. So I've been going out there with hand tools early in the morning so I don't disturb anybody else, and macheteing and hand sawing and hand chainsaw, which is a really cool tool, sort of a half of a chainsaw chain with loops at the end, and loppers, and kind of going into all the brambles that are protecting the pine trees and taking down the extra pines, and then finding little little gifts, like a single straggly little magnolia that could grow up to be beautiful one day, and a locust tree with gorgeous leaves and really long, sharp thorns. And that has been my morning exercise. I've been playing Ultimate 2 or 3 times a week. Fall season starts in a couple of weeks, and I'm captaining again, so I don't have to be on a team where somebody else is captaining. I guess I have a bit of a control freak in me. And so that's garden and movement news both together. All right, time for thanks. Thanks to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song, Sabali Dawn, The Dance of Peace. You can find more of Will's music at his website, willridenour.com. And of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself Podcast patrons. Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Brittany Porter, Dominic Maurer, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Filkinowski, David Bizek, The Mysterious Michelle X, Elsbeth Feldman, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Landry, Josina, Sarah Durkis, Kelly Cameron, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Franzek, Jeanette Benham, Gila Lassert, David Donahue, Blair Cyborg, Dorona Vizov, Gio and Carolyn Argentati, Jody Friesner, Misha Rosen, Michael Warbeck, Aviva Lael, Alicia Lemus, Val Linneman, Nick Harper, Banda Nachali, Molly Levine, The Inscrutable Harry R., Susan Laverty, The Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Scharf, Karen Burry, Heather Morgan, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Koppel, Julian Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Sharon Hirschman, Linda Ayad, Holm Hedegaard, Iza Tuzinwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Lakoski of Plant Powered for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Marani, Karen and Joe Crabtree, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Ann Jesse, Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazelton, Peter W. Evans, Dennis Bird, Darby Kelly, Lori Fanny, Linnea Lundquist, Emily Iconelli, Levy Wallach, Rosamund McAtee, Dan Picorni, Stephen Leenan, Patty DiMartino, Mike and Donna Kartz, Deanne Bishop, Bilberry Elf, Marjorie Lewis, Trisha Adams, Nancy Sheldon, Lindsay Bayshore, Gunmarit Hagen, Tracy Gullidge, Laura Heaton, Meg from Mama Says, Stacey Stokes, Ben Savage, Michael Kay, David Hughes, Connie Rogers, Claire England, Sally Robertson, Paranganchi, Amy Daly, Brian Tourville, Mark Jeffrey Johnson, Josie Dempsey, Karen Schmidt, Pamela Hayden, Emily Perryman, Allison Corbett, Richard Stone, Lauren Vaught of Edible Musings, Aaron Hasty, Sean Owen, Sagar Nayak, Erica Piedra, Danielle Roberts, Michael Lushton, Sarah Johnson, Catherine Floyd, for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for now. As always, be well, my friends.